short orange hair, was slipping out of the third booth from the front door. Neil Parks glanced my way. Our eyes met. Parks bolted. Chapter 24. For a split second, I thought he was headed straight for the back door, the alley, and Samson. Instead, the pimp dodged right in front of me and vaulted over the bar before I could grab him. John stormed into the room with his gun drawn and his badge up. "Parks!" he yelled. "Stop! Police!" Parks disappeared through the curtains to the back. Patrons began to scream and yell, and pool players dived for safety. I jumped onto and over the bar, then barreled at the bartender, who'd ignored me. He looked like he was thinking of blocking my way, but I yelled, 5-0, and he stood aside. Samson came around the bar and reached the curtains first. Remembering the day he was shot, I said, "Be cool now, brother." He hesitated, and then tore back the curtains, revealing a room with empty kegs, a walk-in freezer, and a staircase that climbed up into darkness. We went to the stairs and heard Parks running above us. Samson charged after him, and I charged after Samson. We ran up a utility stairwell with cleated steel treads and steel fire doors on every floor. As we passed the third floor, a door above us opened and then slammed shut. "Stop," Samson whispered. We did. Nothing. "He's going for his apartment, for the computer and that video clip," Samson said softly, and he started to climb again. We reached the fourth floor and opened the stairwell door. Several quick looks revealed no one in the hallway. I grabbed the sleeve of Samson's coat and said loudly, "His place." Then I let the door shut and held my finger to my lips. Samson nodded. We stood there in the stairwell, listening. 10 seconds went by, then 20. I was about to concede that Parks had indeed gone to his apartment when I heard a squeak above me, and then another.
"Neil Parks,"
Samson yelled.
"This is DC Metro. We've got you surrounded."
We could hear him pounding up the stairs again, and we chased him and saw him climb up a ladder bolted into the wall. It gave access to a hatch, which was open. John went first, climbing up and onto the gravel roof. The bluish light cast by the parrot's neon sign made the shadows strange. Samson gestured to me to take the left flank while he went right. We flipped on mag lights and cast the beams about. There were air conditioner compressors on the roof, 8 of them. Parks was either hiding behind one of them or going for a fire escape. We crept forward, staying parallel to each other, about 80 feet apart, using the flashlights to pierce the shadows and the darkness. We'd gone by the 5th and 6th compressors when Samson flushed him out. Parks exploded from behind one of the 2 remaining compressors and ran at a diagonal across the roof. I flipped off my light and tried to cut him off. He was running out of roof, and I was running out of time when I realized he meant to jump to the roof of the next building. The pimp was 3 steps from doing just that when I managed to snag him by the collar of his jacket and shirt. I meant to haul him back and down. Instead, his momentum yanked me forward 2 steps. My lower legs hit the raised roof edge hard, so hard I started to topple over, along with Parks, into the 70 feet of air that separated us from the pavement in the alleyway below. Chapter 25. My head whipped forward and smashed into Parks's head as my body jerked backward. Samson had somehow gotten 2 handfuls of my shirt, and he pulled both me and Parks to safety. My heart was racing, my stomach had turned sour, and I gasped for air. I'd almost fallen 6 stories to certain death. The pimp was equally shaken and offered no resistance when Samson cuffed and searched him. Parks was unarmed and without his cell phone, which was suspicious, given that Sally Sweet told Samson that Parks operated his entire cyber prostitution ring with it. "Where's your phone?" I asked, shining my flashlight in his face. "Lost it the other day," Parks said, blinking and lowering his head. "I was going to get a new one tomorrow."
"Uh-huh," Samson said. "Why'd you run?"
"I like to run," Parks said.
"You mean you like to run prostitutes," I said.
"No, like for fitness," he said, calm and collected now.
"No, like for hookers," Samson said. You got a whole stable of them. Not true, Parks said, and he laughed. Now, who says that? Vice. He looked up then, squinting, and said, You're not Vice. We're Homicide, Samson said. You know Emily McCabe? Parks acted puzzled. No, I don't know an Emily McCabe. Don't be cute, I said. We can prove you know her. The pimp said nothing. We're investigating her murder, Samson said. Her murder? He said, seeming genuinely surprised. She's dead? She's dead, and you killed her, I said. Strangled her on camera. Parks seemed thrown. His mouth hung slightly open, and he stared down at the ground, his mind whirling with questions, no doubt. How had we gotten hold of the video? How should he respond? Samson said, We know you made a snuff film, Neil. We're gonna see you fry for it. No way, he said. I didn't kill no one. You put a rope around Emily's neck while you were having S&M sex with her, I said, and then you strangled her to death. No, he said. I killed her, Samson said. No, Parks said, struggling. And then he apparently resigned himself to the situation. Look, okay, I know Emily, but I did not kill her, because she is not dead. That video was just a fantasy. She made it for me as a kind of going-away present. Give us a break, I said. It's true, Parks said. He went on to claim that Emily McCabe had told him she'd saved enough money to quit the business and was going to school in Florida somewhere. Florida somewhere, Samson said. That's the best you can do. Parks lost his cool then and snapped. It's the only thing I have. Look, I liked Emily a lot. I would never kill her. So tell us how to reach her, I said. I don't know how to reach her, he said. She didn't want me to know. She wanted a clean break and an entirely new life. I respected that. No phone number? I asked. Lost my phone, remember? I'm not buying it, Samson said, marching him back toward the roof hatch. We're taking you in, and we'll be searching your apartment. That snuff film you made is going to send you to prison for the rest of your life. No, wait, Park said. I'm not lying. Emily's alive, somewhere. Hell of a defense, I said. He said nothing this time. After I'd climbed down through the hatch, Samson removed Parks' handcuffs and ordered him at gunpoint onto the ladder. The pimp dropped down and offered no resistance when Samson put the cuffs back on. When we led him down the staircase, Park said, How about I help you and you help me here? Samson grunted. How can you help us, Neil? Parks licked his lips and said, I want you to know that I could be killed for saying this, but I can tell you about real snuff films and the crazy sick bastards that make them. Uh-huh. And what good does that do us? I asked. Parks hesitated again, but then said, Maybe you'll figure out what happened to those blondes that have been disappearing. Like Emily McCabe, Samson said. No, Parks said. Like two blonde lesbian bitches from Pennsylvania. Chapter 26. Two girls crying. Those were the last clear sounds Gretchen Lindell had heard, and that had been hours ago. Two girls crying, Gretchen thought, and she strained to hear more. But through the plywood walls, the 17-year-old heard nothing. No voices, no floorboards creaking, not even a jangle of chain, or a desperate sob. The silence made Gretchen mad beyond reason. She kicked and shook the chain that ran from her left ankle to the wall, and she glared at the little camera mounted high in the far corner where she couldn't reach. Who are you? She screamed. Why am I here? What do you want? Gretchen collapsed into sobs as she had too many times since she'd woken up in a plywood box about the size of a prison cell, dressed in a cheap white flannel nightgown, lying on a new mattress still in its wrapper and covered with thick wool army blankets. There'd been food, a big tub of Kentucky Fried Chicken and bottles of Gatorade, a metal bucket to relieve herself in the corner where her chain would reach, and the single LED light overhead that never went off. The constant light had made Gretchen lose track of time.
As her crying subsided and she pulled the blankets up around her, she realized she had no idea how long she'd been in the box. 3 days? 5? A week? Longer? The kidnapping itself had felt like a nightmare, like something that she'd wake up from. But no matter how many times she slept in the box or how hard she tried to forget, she kept seeing the men grabbing her, kept seeing Ms. Petracek murdered. They shot her like she was nothing. What will they do to me? Gretchen felt panic surge and tried to turn her thoughts to something else. She'd heard her father talk about doing that many times as a way out of pain. She breathed deep into her stomach, held it, then exhaled slowly, seeing her father and mother in her mind, so in love and yet so apart now. What is this doing to Dad? To Mom? Gretchen felt sick at these questions and wanted to cry again. He doesn't deserve this. Neither does she. Haven't they suffered enough? God! Haven't they suffered enough? She thought of her best friend forever, Susan, and her sometime boyfriend, Nick. What are they thinking? Are they trying to find me? Is anyone? Curling up into a fetal position, Gretchen tried to find strength in prayer and in her belief in the good. But the questions kept circling and elbowing their way back into her thoughts. Why am I here? Why is this being done to me? What did I do, God, to deserve this? What if I never see Dad or Mom again? The soft squeal of metal on metal stopped her thoughts, made her sit up and stare in fear at the crude door with the two deadbolts. It had never opened before. The door swung inward. The teenager's hand flew to her mouth, and she stifled a scream. He was football player big and dressed in black, from his motorcycle boots to his wool cap and tinted paintball visor. There was a blinking GoPro camera mounted in a harness on his chest. But she was focused in terror on his right-gloved hand, which held an ornate knife with a curved and wicked-looking blade.
Hello, Gretchen, he said in a strange electronic voice. Are you ready to play a game for us?
Chapter 27. I slipped into bed shortly after 1:30 in the morning, unsure of how much Neil Park's story I believed and too tired to think about it anymore. It felt like only minutes passed between my head hitting the pillow and someone shaking my shoulder. I came to consciousness thickly and cracked open a groggy eye to see Jani and Ali standing by my bed, dressed for the morning jog I'd promised them. I could feel the heat of Bree's body behind me, and not wanting to wake her, I held a finger to my lips. They nodded and crept out of the room. I got up, feeling a little dizzy and wanting 3, maybe 4 more hours of sleep. But these days, a promise to my kids was a promise I tried to keep. I got dressed in the closet and eased out of the room, smelling coffee brewing downstairs. I went to the kitchen, where Nana Mama, in her navy blue nightgown and robe, was already pouring me a small cup of coffee. Jani and Ali were tying their shoelaces. Bless you, I said when she handed the cup to me.
You fall asleep in front of the TV again? Nana Mama asked.
I nodded and took several reviving sips of the coffee.
I think that TV should have an automatic shut-off, my grandmother said.
It does, Ali said. Or the cable box does.
Let's go, I said, wanting to end the conversation. I set the empty cup down. I have a new client coming this morning, and I don't want to be late. We went outside. The first light of day showed in the sky, and the air was cool when we started to run. We took a route that led to Lincoln Park and back, about 4 miles round trip. When I ran alone, I rarely thought, and yet I often got home to find I'd figured out one problem or another. The subconscious at work and all that. But a mindless run was impossible with Ali, especially once Jani picked up her pace after a mile and left us in the dust.
Dad, Ali said, jogging beside me. Did you know that running for more than 30 minutes promotes brain cell regeneration? I glance down at him and wonder again that a 9-year-old, my 9-year-old, could know about brain cell regeneration. Can't say that I did, I said, puffing along. I mean, I know it's good for your heart. And good for your brain, he said. I saw a thing about it online. That's why I told Janny I wanted to start running with her. So you could regenerate your brain cells, I said. Come on, bud. You're 9. You're still growing brain cells and will be for a long time. Ollie looked at me with mild indignation. I'll grow more by running. I raised my hands in surrender. I'll trust you on this. He smiled and said, but not too much running, otherwise my brain will get too big and my head will explode. Won't it, Dad? There was my 9-year-old boy. Dad? No, your brain won't explode from running too much. You're sure? You think Janny's head's going to explode? I glanced over and saw he was alarmed by that idea. No one's head is exploding from being fit, I said as we neared the arboretum. Next subject. Ollie didn't say anything until we reached the park, reversed direction toward home, and were jogging down South Carolina Avenue. Then he said, Dad, do some police in our country hate some people so much they'll just shoot them for no reason? Chapter 28. That one shocked me, and I slowed to a stop, hands on my hips and sweat dripping down my nose. Why would you say that, son? Ali heard the tone of my voice, looked uncertain, and said, I saw some people on TV say that black kids get shot just 'cause they're black, and that you shot those Saniji people just because you hated that dead guy they worship. My stomach felt hollow. A caustic taste came up my throat and made the back of my tongue burn. At last I said, let's start with the first part. Are you scared a police officer might shoot you because of the color of your skin? Should I be scared? Ollie asked, crossing his arms. They said it happens all the time. First off, being a police officer is a very difficult job. You understand that, right? I guess, yes. Second, too many black men are getting shot, I said, and some of them by racists. But on the whole, I think it's more a question of police officers who aren't trained correctly, who don't follow the rules and the most up-to-date methods of law enforcement. Rather than getting calmer, Ali became more upset and started to run away. I ran after him, stopped him, and saw he was in tears. Before I could ask him what the matter was, he blubbered. You don't follow the rules, Dad. That's what the people on TV said. They said you were out of control and represented everything wrong with the police in America today. That felt like a kick to the head. Do you think that? Wiping at his tears, Ali sniffled. But that's what people are saying, Dad, even at school. I put one knee down on the sidewalk and looked up at my son, who was searching my face for answers. I wasn't out of control that night, Ali, I said. I shot those people because they were trying to shoot me. But they said I know what they've said, I said, trying to keep my voice from breaking. All I can say is, it's not true, son. Your dad is not a cold-blooded killer. It was self-defense. You have to believe me. You do believe me, don't you? Ali studied my face for so long, I thought I'd lost him. But then he nodded and hugged me so tight that tears welled up in my eyes and love choked my throat. Thank you, little buddy, I said hoarsely. I don't think I can do this without you watching my back. Chapter 29. 2 hours later and sitting in my basement office, I was feeling depressed by my conversation with Ali. I suppose it's always a blue day when your 9-year-old questions your personal and professional integrity. I tried to get my mind off it by thinking about the things Neil Parks had told us the night before. The pimp said he'd seen a fully downloaded video from... There was a sharp knock at the outer door to the basement. I glanced at my watch. My new client was 5 minutes early. When I opened the outer door, I found a wrung-out, sandy-haired man with sad, sunken blue eyes and weathered looks that made it hard to judge his age. He was dressed in pressed jeans, a starched white shirt, and polished boat moccasins with no socks. And he wore a hammered gold wedding ring, a Rolex watch, and a tiny gold crucifix on a chain around his neck. "Mr. Lindell," I said, holding out my hand. "Alden Lindell," he said, shaking my hand and training those sunken eyes on me. "So glad you could make time to see me, Dr. Cross." "Glad I could find an opening," I said, even though he was my only appointment for the day. I steered him toward my office. "Lindell, that's an unusual name." "Not in Norway," Lindell said. "No, it's just that I've heard it twice recently, and Gretchen is my daughter, Dr. Cross," Lindell choked out. "She goes to the same school as your son, yes?" "Yes," I said, seeing him new all over again. "Yes, of course she does. Ali and I and my entire family, we've all been praying for her safe return." "Thank you, Dr. Cross," he said as his eyes reddened and he gazed toward the ground. I've always found that if you ask a direct question, you get a direct answer, so I said, "How can I help, Mr. Lindell? Why are you here?" Lindell hesitated and then looked at me while turning his palms upward. "To be honest, I'm here to see Dr. Cross the shrink because of my guilt and anxiety, and Dr. Cross the detective because of my dwindling faith in my daughter's survival." I took a seat. "You do know that I'm suspended pending trial." "I read that," Lindell said. "I also read that before your recent troubles, you were one of the best detectives in the country." "Whoever wrote that was being too kind," I said. "And I know the FBI agents in charge of your daughter's case. They're top-notch. When my mom bakes cake, she says you can always use more frosting," Lindell said. "Please say you'll help me find Gretchen before it's too late, and..." Tears dripping down his cheeks. "She, our daughter, our Gretchen, she's everything to us. And now they're torturing us with these unspeakable images." "I'm confused," I said. "Who's torturing you?" Lindell took a tissue and wiped away his tears before reaching into his jeans pocket and coming up with a small blue flash drive in a plastic baggie. "This was in the mailbox when I checked this morning before breakfast," he said. "Go on. Plug it in." Chapter 30. I took the baggie and looked at the flash drive, a Toshiba with 128 GB printed on the face. "You didn't give this to the FBI?" I asked, putting the baggie down and finding latex gloves. "I was on my way here and wanted you to see it first. I don't think the FBI can get to the bottom of this without you. Can you make a copy and give the original to them for me? I have to catch a plane to New York right after I leave here. On top of everything else, my mother's in the hospital." Reluctantly but curious to see what was on the drive, I nodded. With latex gloves on, I took out the drive and plugged it into my laptop. The screen flashed brightly before a video came up that I found sickeningly familiar. A blonde girl in a white nightgown ran through a dim, leafless forest, with a camera operator in full pursuit. It was dusk, and when he caught her and knocked her down, you could not make out the girl's features for the graininess. "Please don't," she begged when the gloved cameraman pulled her up to her knees by her hair. "No," the computer-altered voice said. "Then you want it to be the last time? No more cat and mouse? No more fun?"
"I just want this to be over," she whimpered, a vague shadow now in the gathering darkness on my screen.
"Okay, then," the voice said. "You'll get your wish." I saw a dark slashing motion across her neck. I heard a slick, slicing sound and a disturbing paw noise before the screen froze and that icon of the lock appeared above the link that read www.itsoverblondie.org.co. "Tell me if it's a fake or not," Lindell said, crying again. "That's all I want you to do. Stop this torture before it drives my wife and me mad." I didn't have a private investigator's license. I was suspended pending trial. I should have expressed my sympathy and turned him down flat. But I was a father, too, and I could see the turmoil, the kidnapping, and now this possible snuff film were churning up in him. "You're sure that's Gretchen?" I asked. "I'd know her voice anywhere," he said, looking at me like I was his last best chance. "I'll do what I can," I said. His fists clenched. Lindell smiled through his tears and said, "Bless you, Dr. Cross, from the bottom of my heart. Bless you." Chapter 31. FBI agent Hannah Batra crossed her arms and stared furiously at me from behind the main security station at Quantico. When I cleared security, I said, "I'm sorry, but you weren't picking up your phone and I needed to talk to you." Agent Batra didn't answer, just pivoted on her black high-heeled pumps and marched down the hallway. I hurried to keep up. When I was abreast of her, she hissed, "Coming here like this, are you trying to get me fired, Cross?" I said it was critical and I'm obviously not on a watch list. Sydney let me right through the front gate. "Sydney's known you 18 years. "Well, exactly, we're on the same team." "You don't get it, Cross. You're being tried for murder in D.C. That puts your case within the Bureau's purview." "Believe me, I get it. But what if analyzing this video can save Gretchen Lindell's life, or at least put her parents' fears to rest?" She squinted at me. "I'm confused. Why didn't Lindell give this drive to the agents investigating his daughter's disappearance?" "He was in rough shape. Hadn't slept in days when I saw him. And he was on his way to New York. His mother's been hospitalized." Batra walked a few more steps without comment and then stopped. She bit her lip, looked at the ceiling for a moment. "Video analysis isn't exactly my thing," she said at last. "For that, we have to go to the basement. And Dr. Cross, Agent Batra," she studied me with cold eyes and said, "before we go downstairs, you need to swear, in writing and in the presence of two witnesses, that you'll never tell a soul what you see down there." 10 minutes later, I got in a secure elevator outside the cybercrimes unit feeling like I'd just signed a little bit of my life away. Agent Batra stepped in beside me, put a digital key card in the lock, and hit SB2. "That made me feel quite the criminal," I said as the doors closed. "Close enough these days," Batra said. "Want to clue me in to the reason for all the secrecy?" "You're a bright guy, you'll figure it out," Batra said, as the elevator passed the first sub-basement and began to slow. I noticed a throbbing and thumping sound that got louder and more distinct when we reached the second sub-basement. The elevator doors opened and we were blasted with electronic techno-pop music. It was loud. It was pulsating. It oddly made me want to dance. The music obviously had the same effect on the guy with the flaming red mohawk twerking and gyrating inside the glass-walled lab directly in front of us. He wore denim shorts, a denim vest over a sleeveless black tee, and nothing else. Barefoot, and in time with the beat, he was shaking his booty, pumping those fists, and slashing the air with his mohawk. I broke into a smile. Batra didn't. She exited the elevator and crossed the hall to the lab door. I followed her saying, "Okay, who the hell is that?" "Keith Carl Rawlins," she said, sounding pained. "He calls himself KK or Crazy Cat, depending on the occasion." Chapter 32. Special Agent Batra stopped at the lab door and looked back at me in real discomfort. I said,
"He works for the Bureau? That's why the non-disclosure?"
Batra glared at me. "Rawlins is as brilliant as they come if you want to analyze anything digital. Far better than me, as a matter of fact." That surprised me. I'd always thought Batra was one with the internet. Then I realized the reason for Rawlins' banishment to sub-basement 2. He doesn't fit the conservative J. Edgar G-Man image, does he? "No," Batra said, twisting the doorknob. "KK definitely does not." The music was even louder inside the lab. Past benches clogged with electronic test equipment on the far side of the room,
Rollins danced before an arced array of 8 large computer screens. The screens all showed the same video, people dancing in urban streets, shaking their rare ends to the addictive beat of the music. Batra got around in front of Rollins and waved wildly at him. Rollins made his hands into pretend guns that he pointed at Batra, and then he punched a key on a control board that looked like it belonged in a recording studio. The lab went quiet. Rollins stopped dancing. He waved his fingers playfully at Batra, and in a soft voice that reeked of New Orleans, he said,
"I'll forgive you this time for interrupting my daily Diplo fix. I was just about done regenerating my brain cells anyway."
"My son told me about that," I said before Batra could reply. "Exercising for brain regeneration." Rollins saw me, studied me, and then smiled. He picked up a hand towel from the chair and came over to us, still smiling and patting his sweating skull on either side of the mohawk. He had a gold hoop through his left nostril, and his earlobes featured stretched piercings. In shiny sequins across the chest of his t-shirt were the words, "Goddess Dances."
"You're bigger in person, I must say," Rollins said coyly. "And your son must have read the same article. What are the odds of that, Dr. Cross?"
"I don't know."
"I do," Rollins said. 2 in 1.64 billion, unless you look at it from a string theory perspective, in which case the chance of brain waves vibrating out and crossing others rises exponentially with every person who reads that article."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," I said.
"That's a pity," Rollins said with a pout. "I so enjoy fiery brains and rippling brawn in a single package."
Chapter 33. I chuckled. "You're out of luck on both counts, Special Agent Rollins, which is why I came to see you." Rollins glanced at Batra and laughed.
"No special this or agent that, Dr. Cross. It's just KK or Crazy Cat. I'm a contractor. The Federal Bureau of Investigation could never make me a sworn agent. Am I right, Big Baby B?"
Batra rolled her eyes, said, "We're here to work, Cat, not wallow."
"I think I'd be quite a badass crime fighter," Rollins sniffed. "Despite appearances, I'm honest to a fault and expect the same from those with whom I work. Tell me, Dr. Cross, did you murder those Saniji followers for sport?"
"No."
"Or to right some wrong?"
"It was self-defense." He studied me for ticks and tells but saw none.
"How can I help you?"
"First, a little context." I gave him a synopsis of the story the cyberpimp Neil Parks had told Samson and me. Parks claimed he had been in Newport News, Virginia, several weeks before scoping out the military town for an expansion of his business. Partying in a strip club there, the pimp met 2 men in their early 30s who went by Billy Ray and Carver. The 3 men hit it off and drank and snorted too much late into the night. Billy Ray, who was more a talker than Carver, told Neil Parks they were trolling for blondes to use in movies they produced for several profitable sites on the dark web. One of the most recent and most successful, Billy Ray said, featured 2 young blonde lesbians from Pennsylvania. He gave Parks the URL of one of the websites, www.itsoverblondie.org.co. I dug in my pocket and came up with the Ziploc containing the Toshiba flash drive. The same URL is featured on the video on this drive. I want to know if the video's real or not. Rollins became all business at that point. He took the bag and asked where I'd gotten the drive, and I told him about Gretchen Lindell's father.
"He should have brought this directly to the agents on his daughter's case," Rollins said, moving toward one of his workbenches.
"It's complicated," I said.
"You've watched what's on the drive?"
"If it's real, it's the first actual snuff film I've ever seen."
"You just want to know if it's fake."
"He wants to know everything and anything," Batra said. "So do I."
Rollins said, "You make a copy?"
"On my laptop at home," I said.
"No crashes?"
"Worked fine."
"I'll check it anyway," he said, sitting down at a computer.
He donned latex gloves, got out the drive, and inserted it into a USB port.
A few moments later, I watched a scanning icon count down the minute and 45 seconds it took to do a full inspection of the flash drive. At the end of the scan, a message appeared. No known anomaly detected.
Well, all righty then, Rawlins said.
He disconnected the flash, took it to the larger control board below the 8 big screens, and plugged it into a server linked to the internal FBI network. A digital index of the drive popped up on the large center screen. It showed the icon of the single MPEG movie file. Rawlins clicked on it. There was a brilliant flash, and then the clip played. The grainy video of the hysterical blonde running through the forest with the cameraman in hot pursuit.
What was that? Batra asked.
That flash at the beginning there.
I don't know,
Rawlins said, freezing the video.
I said, you know. Come to think of it, when I hit the icon on my laptop, it did the same thing, only my screen's much smaller and older, so it wasn't as bright as that.
Rawlins grunted and gave his computer orders to list all running processes and applications. The directory opened and showed them in a stack sorted by the time each was launched, beginning with the most recent app.
That's what just flashed there? Batra said with an arched eyebrow. Porn grinder?
Chapter 34. Rawlins laughed and said blithely,
Oh no, porn grinder is on me. What can I say? It's a lonely life in the basement at times.
My God, Batra said, disgusted. The Bureau frowns on that kind of thing.
Have 'em sue me, won't you? Rawlins said.
What was the flash? Batra said.
I don't know, a blip, a screen hiccup. They happen, you know.
Or a bug in the plugin that drives the video player? Batra said. Rawlins held up a finger.
A momentous occasion. Special Agent Hannah B. and I might agree.
Batra rolled her eyes. Tell us about the video.
I won't bore anyone with the details of Rawlins's technological savvy and instincts, but they were shrewd and his results conclusive.
At first, he used ordinary software to try to access the video file's so-called dark data. No luck. The video had been through an onion system similar to the one used to create the Killing Blonde Chicks for Fun website. The dark data had been stripped away.
Not surprising, Rawlins sniffed, but I've still got the dust rag.
The dust rag was software Rawlins had designed and coded himself to raise the faintest trace of old, dark, and metadata. He compared the software to the Hubble Space Telescope looking for cosmic debris 1,000 miles behind a comet's long tail. Sure enough, his screen was soon filled with fragments of code that played out in sync with the video. By focusing on the moments where the lighting was dimmest and the noise of the alleged killing most pronounced, Rawlins found evidence in the data dust that suggested an audio splice in the soundtrack roughly 6 seconds long. Those 6 seconds included the knife across the throat slitting noise and the pa that sounded like air bursting out of a frightened and dying chest.
She's alive, Rawlins said barely 15 minutes after starting his examination. Or at least, those weren't the sounds of her murder.
I sighed with relief. I wouldn't have to give Alden Lindell or his wife more heartbreaking news. Explain how you know, the parents will ask.
Rawlins said, The sound patch itself is fairly sophisticated CGA, computer-generated audio. So, someone's had advanced training in sound effects. You're looking for a film school grad or someone who worked in a special effects company out in Hollywood, not a coder.
Why's that? Batra asked.
Rawlins gave his computer a command, and the video on the center screen rewound to the beginning of the 6 second splice. A second screen showed the remnants of the dark data. He pointed out a jagged line of data that almost connected top to bottom.
That's your digital splice, Rawlins said. A more adept coder would have hidden it better, sewn it up as clean as a plastic surgeon.
There wouldn't have been even a hint of a scar.
So, this is basic sound editing work, I said. Rawlins touched his mohawk as if it were a high fashion hairdo and said,
3 steps above butchery, and that's all I can manage now. I have a lot to do before Goddess opens.
I was puzzled. His favorite dance club, Batra explained.
Do you dance, Dr. Cross?
Rollins said. Before I could reply, my cell phone buzzed in my pocket. I pulled it out, saw the number. My son's school, I said. I have to take this. Chapter 35. Ali Cross believed he was smarter than the average kid at Washington Latin, but not brilliant, not a genius. The kids he considered super smart were also the shyest and the most awkward. He decided within a month of starting at the charter school that brilliance was overrated. He'd take very bright, very hard-working, and very curious any day of the week. Ali was the youngest kid in fifth grade at Latin by at least a year. With his attitude and sense of humor, he fit in with most of his older classmates. But, as his father always said, there were jerks in every crowd. Ali met two of them shortly after the school bell rang to announce the end of classes. He had 15 minutes before debate practice and decided to go sit outside. It was a nice sunny afternoon, not too cold. Ali stopped on the front steps and looked toward the plaza, remembering the hooded men who grabbed Gretchen Lindell and shot Ms. Petrichek. Rather than dwell on those violent events, he sat up on the wall at the top of the stairs and started playing a game on his phone. He was aware of knots and kids walking past him, and he caught snatches of their conversation. Suddenly, someone grabbed him by the collar, right below his chin, and pushed as if to shove him backward off the wall. Then, whoever it was, yanked him forward again. Shocked, surprised, Ali felt his stomach go sick with adrenaline and fear before he'd fully realized what had happened. George Putnam, a burly sixth grader, still held Ali so tight by the collar he was having trouble getting his breath. The older boy laughed at his reaction.
"Saved your life," Putnam said. "You little turd, Cross."
"Let go," Ali said. "You're choking me." Putnam's buddy, Coulter Tate, was taller and already fighting acne. Tate leaned over, got right in Ali's face, and gave him a crazed, zitty look.
"How's it feel to be a killer's son, Cross?" Tate said. "How's it feel to have murder in the genes?"
Putnam tightened his hold, making Ali's eyes feel like they were swelling. There was no thought, no consideration on Ali's part after that. He just pulled back his head and then slammed it forward. His forehead connected with Tate's nose, and he heard a distinct crunching noise. Tate screamed and stumbled back, holding his hand to his nose, which was gushing blood.
"He broke it,"
he sobbed in disbelief.
"He broke my nose."
Putnam was still holding on, looking shocked as he stared at his bleeding buddy, and Ali punched him in the throat. Putnam let go of Ali's collar and went down on the stairs, bug-eyed and coughing, his hands to his neck. Ali was still in a fighting stance and trembling head to toe when Mrs. Dalton, the headmistress at Washington Latin, came running out of the school.
"My God, what's happening?" she cried.
Ali didn't reply or move. He kept his attention on the 2 sixth graders as if daring them to get up.
"He broke my nose, Mrs. D,"
Tate said, the blood dripping between his fingers.
"And the little frickin' insano hit George in the throat."
"Ali," Mrs. Dalton said. "Why did you—"
"I'm not talking until my dad's here," Ali said, trying to stay calm. "You will tell me now, young man," she said, sounding angry and full of authority. "Right now."
"Sorry, Mrs. Dalton," Ali said, feeling weak as he dropped his fists and turned to face her.
"Please get my dad here, or a lawyer, and then I'll tell you exactly what happened."
Chapter 36. Traffic was snarled as I crossed back into the district, and I wondered what Ali had gotten himself into that was so bad it deserved an immediate meeting. The headmistress wouldn't tell me a thing. Inching over the Theodore Roosevelt Bridge, I decided to call Alden Lindell. He answered on the third ring.
"This is Alex Cross, Mr. Lindell. I'm happy to tell you that Gretchen did not die in that video. It was a fake."
Her father made a noise partway between a cough and a cry.
"Oh, good," he gasped. "Oh, thank God. Are you sure? How do you know?" because a very talented FBI computer wizard said that the video's audio was altered. The sounds weren't real.
But it was Gretchen's voice, he said. I'd swear it.
I believe you, Mr. Lindell, but that wasn't the sound of her dying. I wanted you to know. Please tell your wife.
Yes, yes, right away.
I'll be in touch if I hear more. Well, I could still use someone to talk to, Dr. Cross, he said. Eliza, Gretchen's mother, and I, we were separated before Gretchen was taken, and this has been even more of a strain. And my mother's not well, and we're thinking about endings.
I'm sorry to hear all that, Mr. Lindell. Give my office a call tomorrow. We'll make an appointment.
Thank you, Dr. Cross.
You're welcome, I said, and I clicked the phone off.
Traffic was moving finally. 15 minutes later, I parked close to Washington Latin and hurried inside toward the waiting area outside the offices of the headmistress and the other school administrators. From well down the hallway, I could see Coulter Tate sitting on the right side of the waiting room. He held an ice pack to his face. A woman I took to be his mother had her arm around his shoulders and was whispering in his ear. Two or three chairs away, George Putnam pressed a bag of ice to his throat. Sitting beside him was a man I figured was his father, a big dude with a wrestler's build stuffed into a $5,000 suit. He was staring bullets across the room at Ali, who sat with his eyes closed.
Dr. Cross!
I looked behind me and spotted Mrs. Dalton hurrying over.
Dr. Cross,
the headmistress said with an exasperated sigh.
Before we get to the fight, I must speak to you first about your son's insubordinate behavior.
A school like Latin, please.
I'd like to speak to my son in private right now.
Dr. Cross, she said, raising her chin,
I don't think you, as far as I'm concerned, and with all due respect, I think Ali did the right thing by not talking, Mrs. Dalton. He's a minor, but he has certain rights. Among those is his right to have a parent present during questioning.
That's with the police, she said. I run a school, and I wish to be present when he first tells his side of things.
You really want to fight me on parental rights? Because you'll waste a bunch of money on lawyers and you'll lose.
Mrs. Dalton was a smart woman used to getting her way, a woman who hated losing. I could see it in her eyes. But she said,
Very well, Dr. Cross, you can use my office. 10 minutes. There are other parents and students to consider.
Thank you, Mrs. Dalton. I know you're in a difficult situation, and I appreciate your handling it with such grace. She hesitated, but then tilted her head and gestured toward the waiting room. I walked in. When I did, Coulter Tate, the kid with the broken nose, shrank away, curled up, and whined fearfully.
What's gotten into you, honey? His mother said, craning her head over her shoulder to look at me.
He kills people, Mom, Tate said. He teaches his kid to kill, too.
Shut up, Coulter, Ali said, opening his eyes. You're such an ass.
Language, I said. Ali looked relieved, got up, and hugged me. I looked at Mrs. Dalton and ignored the others. She led us down a hall to her office and closed the door after we went inside.
You okay, bud?
My forehead hurts, he said, and he hugged me again.
Mrs. Dalton's not happy, I said.
So give me the truth, everything. Chapter 37. I opened the door 10 minutes later and found Mrs. Dalton standing there looking flustered.
I was about to knock, she said.
Or you were trying to listen in, I thought, but I said, Call in the others, they'll want to hear Ali's side of things.
Why?
Because those boys are lying to you, and Ali can prove it. 5 minutes later, three kids and three parents were crammed into Mrs. Dalton's office. None of us looked happy.
Expect a suit for damages, bucko,
George Putnam's father said, shaking a big finger at me. I'm a lawyer.
You're kidding, I said.
I never would have guessed.
Let's be respectful, shall we? Mrs. Dalton said. Hear Ali's version?
He's a liar, George Putnam said in a hoarse voice.
Ali shook his head.
You dolt, Putnam. I haven't said anything yet.
I put my hand on Ali's shoulder and squeezed.
Stick to the facts, I said. No name calling. Address Mrs. Dalton.
Ali wasn't happy,
but he nodded and told Mrs. Dalton that Putnam had grabbed him while he sat on the wall and pushed him back, hard. If he'd let go, Ollie would have dropped close to 6 feet to the concrete and probably would have been gravely injured.
"But I didn't let go," Putnam said. "I pulled you back. It was a joke. Saved your life. Jeez."
Ollie said, "He did pull me back, and he did say, saved your life. But then, Coulter stuck his face in mine and started talking trash about my dad."
"So you headbutted him?" Tate's mom said bitterly. "You can't do that. They were fooling around, but you took it as a chance to really hurt someone."
"Like father, like son," Tate said.
"It's true," Putnam's father said. "Ollie didn't have to punch George in the throat. The game was over and he suckered my boy."
"George was still choking me after I headbutted Coulter," Ollie said, looking Mrs. Dalton right in the eye. "I feared for my life. I swung for his face, but I hit him in the throat."
"Feared for your life?" Putnam rasped. "Are you kidding?"
"Did you have hold of my collar when I hit you, George?" Ollie said. "All the other kids have gone home, but I know someone must have seen it. They'll back me up eventually, so tell the truth now."
Putnam opened his mouth angrily, painfully. He hesitated, swallowed hard, and said,
"I might have been holding your collar, but I never choked you."
"Never? No."
Ollie unbuttoned several buttons on his shirt and then spread the lapels. There were raised welts around his neck.
"Clear sign of attempted strangulation," I said.
"What?" Putnam's father cried. "That's BS. You could have done that when you were in talking to him."
Ollie held out his phone and said, "I may be 9, but I'm not stupid. I took pictures in the bathroom an hour ago. A bunch, all time-stamped. So, case closed. This was self-defense, or should we take you all to court and sue for batteries?"
I hid my smile and said, "That's multiple counts of battery."
"Oh," Ollie said, grinning.
"Right."
There was a long silence in the room. Finally, Mrs. Dalton said, "George, Coulter, a 5-day suspension."
"Are you serious?"
Coulter's mother whined.
"No,"
Putnam's father said.
"Yes," Mrs. Dalton said.
"And if they're ever involved with something like this again, they will be expelled from Washington Latin."
"I'm writing the board of overseers about this," Putnam's father said. 5 days for them and nothing for the kid who did the damage? I don't think so."
"I didn't say that," Mrs. Dalton said, and she looked at me and then my son.
"Ollie, a 3-day suspension."
"What?" he cried. "It was self-defense."
The headmistress was unmoved.
"You signed a code of conduct when you enrolled in Washington Latin. That code says, among other things, no fighting will be tolerated under any circumstances. None. Remember?"
"Yes, but..."
"No buts," she said, looking at me. "He signed the contract, so did you, Dr. Cross, and your wife."
"Yes, we did," I said, "and we will abide by it."
"Dad!"
"Case closed," I said.
Chapter 38. The next morning, after a long jog with Janny and an excellent shower, I went down to the kitchen with Nana Mama and poured a mug of coffee for Bree. She shuffled to the table, yawning and running on fumes. There'd been a gang fight the evening before, 3 dead on top of a homicide caseload that was already bulging with backlog. She hadn't gotten home until 2, and now she had to turn around and go back in for a meeting with the chief at 9. I put the coffee in front of her.
"Bless you, baby," Bree said, smiling weakly. She sipped the coffee.
"I'll be your barista anytime," I said.
"So tell me about Ollie."
"Hmm," Nana Mama said, and she went back to stirring eggs for a scramble. I took a seat across from my wife.
"Well, he was like a little pro arguing his defense in there. Very logical. And it was his idea to lay a trap for them by not mentioning the neck welts to Mrs. Dalton before then."
"A regular Perry Mason," Nana Mama said, and she didn't mean it in a good way. "Fighting on the school steps. That would not have happened back when I was a vice principal. Never."
My grandmother, dressed in her quilted blue robe, still had her back to us and was whipping the eggs furiously. Bree shaped an O with her lips and tried not to smile. Nana, I said, what was Ali supposed to do? Let himself be choked to death?
I didn't say that, she said sharply, and she turned to face me. I'm just concerned for your son's reputation, which takes a long time to build.
Hearing echoes of similar things she'd said to me over the years, I said, yes, ma'am, that's a fact.
Long as it takes to build, a reputation can die in 2 seconds, Alex, she said,
and she made a shh sound of disgust. I know that, and honestly, Nana, I think Ali did the right thing, considering the circumstances, and he's getting punished for it, so he's learning the world can be unfair sometimes.
I agree, Bree said, in a lot of ways. Ali's reputation will only be stronger after this. I mean, he's 9 years old, and he stood up to bullies who were 12.
Be proud of him, Nana. He did good, even if it meant getting suspended. My grandmother looked perplexed. I got up and hugged her. Sometimes you have to break the rules. Sometimes you have to protect yourself. Nana Mama held herself rigid at first, but then she melted and hugged me back.
You know I don't like fighting.
I do.
Where'd he learn to fight like that?
He says from YouTube videos on Krav Maga, the Israeli fighting system.
Maybe his time on the internet should be limited?
I agree, I said and kissed her sweet old head. My cell phone rang. I let go of my grandmother and answered. Alex Cross?
Bernie Aliyah, Dr. Cross, he said gruffly. It's Tess. She's barricaded herself in her bedroom. She's got a gun, and I'm afraid she's going to kill herself if you don't come talk to her.
Chapter 39. Suspended D.C. Metro detective Tess Aliyah lived in a duplex row house walk-up near downtown on a street heading from renovation toward gentrification. Dumpsters squatted in front of 3 or 4 other row houses on the block. Hammers and saws popped and whined inside them. A circular saw squealed nearby, masking the sound of me climbing up to Tess's front porch. Her father opened the door before I could ring the bell, and he limped out to shake my hand. Bernie Aliyah was pale, and his face was scratched and bruised. I could see everything from fright to anger in his eyes.
I told you I'd get Tess the help she needed, Dr. Cross, Bernie said in a low, agitated voice. And I tried in the best way I knew how. But she got real defensive when I suggested the evaluation. When I told her it was for her own good, just to know what's what, she went out of her mind. She attacked me, scratched me, and hit me with something that knocked me on my ass.
He shook his head in disbelief and sorrow.
Tess was always like her mother, always level-headed, even as a little girl.
She's still your little girl, I said, but she's been wounded.
Talk to her. Make her see it wasn't her fault.
Feeling his desperation, I took a deep breath and said, I can try. Where's her bedroom?
Top of the stairs to the right.
The gun?
Her backup. She surrendered her service pistol.
You know what prescriptions she's taking?
What isn't she taking? The kitchen counter's covered with them.
Then I want to take a look there first. He led me inside, past a steep staircase, and into a small modern kitchen. The counter held a blooming array of prescription drugs. I picked up the canisters one by one and studied them. Some names I recognized. I got out my smartphone and typed names of the medicines I didn't know into drugs.com. I scanned all the drugs' therapeutic effects, scribbled a few notes, and then used the site to look for possible interactions. When I finished, I was upset and I whispered, Bernie, is Tess taking all of these or just some?
She won't tell me, and I can't get a damn doctor's on the phone.
I grabbed the bottles and looked for the prescribers' names. In all, 5 physicians had prescribed 12 different meds for Tess Aliyah in the past 6 weeks. Her father said,
What do you think?
If she's taking half these drugs at the same time,
It's a wonder she hasn't been committed for psychotic behavior already.
Jesus H. Christ, Bernie moaned. I knew it. I told my girlfriend something was wrong, but Jesus, I just didn't push it.
Tess is a grown woman, I said, and I patted him on the arm. You coming? She'll want you at some point, but please don't say anything unless I give you the nod, okay? He didn't like that.
I've done my share of talking people off ledges.
I bet you.